The headlines: Iran's president says Tehran's decision to enrich uranium at 60% purity is a response to nuclear terrorism against the country. U.S. state of Minnesota witnesses protest for the third straight night over the latest police killing of a black man. And also, Brazil's Senate launches a probe into President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus pandemic in the Latin American country. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president says Tehran has responded to nuclear terrorism at Natanz nuclear facility by installing more modern centrifuges and enriching uranium to higher purity levels.
They wanted to disrupt the operations of IR-1 centrifuges, but Iran's first response was to replace those centrifuges with IR-6 ones so that they will understand they cannot deprive Iran of peaceful nuclear technology through wicked acts. As a second response, Iran will also increase uranium enrichment from 3.67% purity level to 60%.
Rouhani said Iran will not allow others to disrupt its peaceful nuclear program and will counter any plots in that regard. He reiterated that Iran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal once the U.S. removes all sanctions, abides by its commitments, and respects UN Security Council Resolution 2231. The president underlined that Iran's activities have always been and will remain peaceful and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday we sent a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked, that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Well, the United States says it remains committed to nuclear negotiations with Iran in light of Tehran announcing its decision to enrich uranium to 60% purity. President Joe Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki, said the administration believes the diplomatic approach is the only path forward and that having a discussion, even indirect, is the best way to come to a resolution. Meanwhile, France said it's readying a response to Iran's announcement. The French presidency added that the Iranian move is a serious development, which needs to be coordinated at least with the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says Iran's decision to further scale back its JCPOA commitments has legal merit.
Yes, this is, Iran is being completely reasonable. It is, the Iranian government is doing what it needs to do for its people to protect them, provide them with nuclear energy that's required. The other signatories have violated the agreement, first the United States, and then the European signatories following along with the U.S. It's very clear, and the Iranian government, Iranian spokespeople have said from the start that if the United States removes all sanctions and re-enters the JCPOA in full compliance, then Iran will comply also. The U.S. is demanding that Iran go first and comply fully. But the Iranian government has no reason to believe what the U.S. says and to accept the U.S.'s commitments. So the Iranian government, in increasing the enrichment rate and in demanding that U.S. remove sanctions first, is completely reasonable and completely within the law.
A U.S. intelligence analysis has concluded that Iran is not undertaking activities toward developing a nuclear weapon. The study represents the conclusions of all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies. According to the report, analysts say, or rather see few indications Iran will seek to change course. Iran has always maintained that its nuclear program is peaceful and merely for civilian purposes. Tehran also says it has never sought to make weapons of mass destruction, including nukes. Iran is a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and its nuclear work has been under the IAEA's intense scrutiny. The Islamic Republic says it's committed to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Iran's leader has also issued a religious decree that bans building nuclear arms. Iran has summoned the ambassador of Portugal, the current holder of the European Union's rotating presidency, to protest the bloc's latest batch of anti-Tehran sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry slammed the sanctions as politically motivated. It noted that Tehran is considering counter-sanctions against the bloc. Iran has already said it will suspend comprehensive negotiations with the EU, which includes talks on human rights and all cooperation based on the talks. This includes cooperation regarding refugees and fighting terrorism and drug trafficking. On Monday, the EU added 8 Iranian officials and 3 entities to its sanctions blacklist over alleged violation of human rights. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusation and criticized Europe for its double standard on the issue of human rights. American protesters have taken to the streets in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, for the third straight night over the police killing of a black man. The demonstrators rallied despite a police ban on public gathering. Chaotic scenes occurred when police used pepper spray and flash bombs to disperse the crowd, who responded with throwing bottles and projectiles. The third night of protests comes despite the resignation of the police chief and the officer who fatally shot Dante Wright. He was killed after officers attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation on Sunday. The incident has once again sparked anger against police racism in the state of Minnesota, where police last year killed another black man, George Floyd. His death led to months of protests across the U.S. Coronavirus infections have hit a new peak in several Latin American countries as the number of cases and fatalities keeps rising worldwide. Argentina reported a record 27,000 cases in the past 24 hours. The government is now considering new emergency measures and restrictions. In Colombia, President Ivan Duque announced a lockdown in several cities in an attempt to halt the advance of a third wave of the disease. In Brazil, the world's third hardest hit country in terms of total cases, the Senate has launched a probe into President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the outbreak. He's drawn widespread criticism for his approach to the coronavirus, and Uruguay has gone from one of the least affected countries to registering the most new daily cases per capita in the world. While France tries to catch up its delay in the vaccination campaign against COVID-19, a large number of vaccination centers are being inaugurated, but medical experts say the real problem is the lack of doses, not the lack of vaccination places. Our correspondent, Christine Hond, has more from Paris.
After the Velodrome and the Hippodrome, France has now the Vaccinodrome. This is a huge vaccination center against the coronavirus, the state de France in Saint-Saint-Denis, the Paris suburb, one of the poorest areas in the country. France has been one of the slowest European Union countries to vaccinate its population, and the government tries now to catch up. But medical experts say that it's still too little and too late. Local vaccination centers in the east of Paris are complaining about the shortage of vaccine doses. Many different vaccines exist today in the world, but they are not produced in enough quantity. The reason? EU governments, including France, refuse to import and produce massively available vaccines like the relatively cheap Russian Sputnik vaccine. Furthermore, the pharmaceutical industry blocks any lift on patents.
The solution proposed by South Africa and India and supported by 100 countries on lifting the patents on vaccines has been refused by France and other EU member states. If you lift the patents, you can produce enough vaccine doses.
Medical experts plead for free vaccines as a public service. That's the exact opposite of what the pharmaceutical industry and the EU governments are doing today. And the lack of vaccine doses puts poor people directly in danger, especially here in the popular northern suburb of Paris. The World Health Organization has criticized France for the slowness of its vaccination campaign. Huge vaccination centers like this will not resolve the problem if the number of vaccine doses do not increase seriously. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Russia says it will continue dialogue over tensions with neighboring Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin made the remark in a telephone call with his American counterpart Joe Biden. The White House said Biden urged Putin to de-escalate tensions with Kiev and voiced concern over Russia's military buildup in Crimea and on the Ukrainian border. Moscow says its troop deployments are in response to NATO's military activities that threaten Russia. The Kremlin says NATO's involvement in Ukraine has turned the country into a, quote, powder keg. Crimea rejoined Russia after a referendum in 2014, but Ukraine and its Western allies called the reunification an annexation. Since then, conflict has simmered between Kiev and Moscow with a recent spike in violence in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass. China has defended its military exercises in the Taiwan Strait amid escalating tensions with Chinese Taipei and the United States. A spokesman for the Chinese Taipei Affairs Office says those combat drills are necessary to safeguard its national security. The spokesman has urged the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and properly handle the issue of Chinese Taipei. China has deployed 25 fighter jets and bombers to the Taiwan Strait to join its aircraft carrier there. The Chinese military has carried out exercises near Chinese Taipei recently and is planning more. Chinese Taipei has warned about the possibility of China launching an attack against it. Meanwhile, the U.S. has sent an unofficial delegation to Chinese Taipei. The White House says the move shows President Joe Biden's commitment to the self-ruled island. Pakistan has been the scene of violent protests after the government apparently backed out of its commitment to expel the French ambassador. The repeated publications of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in France has been the main cause of anger in Pakistan. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
It was a pitch battle in garrison city of Rawalpindi, near Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. These were repeated scenes across Pakistan. The violent clashes erupted after what protesters blamed the government to have backed out of its agreement with them to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan over the repeated incidents of public display and republication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Many died and dozens of others injured from the both sides in the clashes after the protesters blocked the major railways and road links. Protesters claimed that at least 10 of their companions were killed and over 100 were arrested by the police.
This government doesn't care about the dignity of our Prophet. Obviously, people take to the streets to show their anger. We gave the government 5 months to expel the French ambassador, but they did not expel him. We will continue our protests until our demand is met, which is the expulsion of French ambassador.
Pakistan has a history of similar violent protests over the frequent incidents of blasphemy of the Prophet under the guise of freedom of expression in the West. Protecting the honor of the Prophet is the most sensitive issue in Pakistan, which attracted millions of people on the roads in the past.
Sending the French ambassador back may be a kind of a step which, again, could provide an immediate relief as far as the domestic political scene is concerned, but that is not going to solve the problem. Today it is France, tomorrow it will be another country. And so we need to be having a comprehensive campaign.
Pakistan has been under pressure from Paris-based anti-money laundering outfit, the Financial Action Task Force, which placed Pakistan on grey list few years ago on the charges of terror financing. Now Pakistan needs French support together with other countries to come out of the grey list, because of which Islamabad is reluctant to expel French ambassador. However, rising anti-French sentiments in Pakistan are leaving little option with the government but to expel French ambassador. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Afghans welcome the arrival of the fasting month of Ramadan with honor and pride, despite facing numerous challenges, including poverty, the COVID-19 pandemic, and increasing violence and bloodshed. Here's a report.
As the fasting month of Ramadan arrives, Afghans happily welcome it with honor and pride. In the meantime, poverty and low control over prices in the market by the government are major problems that poor families are facing. That is why they call on responsible bodies to take strict measures in order to control the market during the holy month.
We want businesses to think about difficulties of the poor during the fasting month of Ramadan. Government bodies also need to fully control food prices and prevent sharp price hikes during Ramadan to help poor families and individuals.
Fasting Afghans also see this month as an opportunity for not only strengthen their bonds with God, but also to further help and support the underprivileged in society. That is one of the fundamental teachings of Islam.
This is the religious and humanitarian responsibility of every single Muslim to help poor people, especially orphans and widows who have no breadwinner, and Ramadan creates opportunities for us to fulfill our responsibility in this regard.
Besides other challenges, the COVID-19 pandemic in Afghanistan is also a problem on the way of fasting Afghans. This is because they religiously organize big gatherings during the holy month each year. The continuation of terrorist attacks and bombings during the fasting month of Ramadan is one of the other headaches for Afghans, especially for military forces who are either in the front lines or inside their posts and bases across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
And that's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Calls are mounting for the Biden administration to undertake a count as the KHN Guardian project comes to a close. The project, which tracked who died and why, provides a window into the workings and failings of the U.S. health system during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by James Spencer and Christina Jewett, researchers. This article is published under the heading More than 3,600 U.S. healthcare workers have died in the pandemic's first year. Stay tuned for the details, please. More than 3,600 U.S. healthcare workers perished in the first year of the pandemic, according to Lost on the Frontline, a 12-month investigation by The Guardian and KHN to track such deaths. Lost on the Frontline is the most complete accounting of U.S. healthcare worker deaths. The federal government has not comprehensively tracked this data. But calls are mounting for the Biden administration to undertake a count as the KHN Guardian project comes to a close. The project, which tracks who died and why, provides a window into the workings and failings of the U.S. health system during the COVID-19 pandemic. One key finding, two-thirds of diseased healthcare workers for whom the project has data identified as people of color, revealing the deep inequities tied to race, ethnicity, and economic status in America's healthcare workforce. Lower-paid workers who handled everyday patient care, including nurses, support staff, and nursing home employees, were far more likely to die in the pandemic than physicians were. The year-long series of investigative reports found that many of these deaths could have been prevented. Widespread shortages of masks and other personal protective gear, a lack of COVID testing, weak contact tracing, inconsistent mask guidance by politicians, missteps by employers, and lax enforcement of workplace safety rules by government regulators all contributed to the increased risk faced by healthcare workers. Studies show that healthcare workers were more than three times as likely to contract COVID as the general public. We rightfully refer to these people without hyperbole, that they are true heroes and heroines, said Dr. Anthony Fauci in an exclusive interview with The Guardian and KHN. The COVID deaths of so many are a reflection of what healthcare workers have done historically by putting themselves in harm's way, by living up to the oath they take when they become physicians and nurses, he said. More than 100 journalists contributed to a project in an effort to record every health, death, and memorialize those who died. The project's journalists filed public records requests, cross-connected governmental and private data sources, scoured obituaries and social media posts, and confirmed death through family members, workplaces, and colleagues. Among its key findings, more than half of those who died were younger than 60. In the general population, the median age of death from COVID is 78. Yet among healthcare workers, in the database, it is only 59. More than a third of the healthcare workers who died were born outside the United States. Those from the Philippines accounted for a disproportionate number of deaths. Nurses and support staff members died in far higher numbers than physicians. And twice as many workers died in nursing homes as in hospitals. Only 30% of deaths were among hospital workers, and relatively few were employed by well-funded academic medical centers. The rest worked in less prestigious residential facilities, outpatient clinics, hospices, and prisons, among other places. study published in late March found that only 4 of 8,121 fully vaccinated employees at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas became infected. But deaths lag behind infections, and KHN and The Guardian have tracked more than 400 healthcare worker deaths since the vaccine rollout began. Many factors contributed to the high toll, but investigative reporting uncovered some consistent problems that heighten the risks faced by health workers. The project found that Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance on masks, which encouraged hospitals to reserve high-performance N95 masks for intubation procedures, and initially suggested surgical masks were adequate for everyday patient care, may have put thousands of health workers at risk. The investigation exposed how the Labor Department, run by Donald Trump appointee Eugene Scalia in the early part of the pandemic, took a hands-off approach to workplace safety. It identified 4,100 safety complaints filed by healthcare workers to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Labor Department's workplace safety agency. Most were about PPE shortages, yet even after some complaints were investigated and closed by regulators, workers continued to die at the facilities in question. The reporting also found that healthcare employers were failing to report worker deaths to OSHA. The data analysis found that more than a third of workplace COVID deaths were not reported to regulators.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's sabotage at the Natanz nuclear facility, Iran announces the terrorist act has not been able to achieve its goal of hampering the country's internationally verified peaceful nuclear program. Iran will not only replace the damaged centrifuges with more advanced ones, it'll also put to operation 1,000 more advanced centrifuges soon. On top of that, Iran will raise uranium enrichment level from 20% to 60% as of tomorrow. And all this while, Tehran is engaged in talks with the P4 plus one in Vienna regarding the lifting of U.S.-imposed sanctions aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. Stay with us for a debate on different aspects of this issue.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday, we send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current numbers, current number of machines. Also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked, that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop a thirst for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Okay, now let's start the debate here. Joining me tonight here will be security analyst Mohan Abedi in our Tehran studios. We'll also have journalist and commentator Julia Kassamba joining us out of Beirut. Good to have you, both of you in the show. Now let's go to Mohan first. Mohan, this is not the first time that the Tel Aviv regime is trying to throw a wrench into Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But the irony is that the hostile action prompted Iran to further its nuclear activity. As of tomorrow, as you know, Iran will start uranium enrichment at 60%. The country will also put to operation 1,000 advanced centrifuges. It looks like that the Israeli scheme has failed again, don't you agree?
Well, you know, Israel and other hostile states have been trying to sabotage Iran's civilian nuclear program and other critical national infrastructure for more than 15 years now. And these sabotage operations have taken different forms, cyber attacks, terrorism, bomb attacks, the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. And with all these attacks, undoubtedly, they gain some operational or technical advantage. But these attacks have never, ever, up to now, managed to change the big strategic picture. They do not change Iran's calculus and Iran's determination to go ahead with its development plans. Now, today's announcement was a very good example. These hostile states, we assume it's Israel, it hasn't been confirmed yet, took action against a critical national infrastructure, and Iran's response is to speed up nuclear enrichment from 20% to 60%, bring into line new state-of-the-art centrifuges, a new generation of centrifuges. And bear in mind, much of the centrifuges that have been damaged in previous attacks, they belong to a previous generation of centrifuges. So they were, by today's standards, pretty useless anyway. So in direct answer to your question, a hostile state will undertake these actions with a view to gaining some kind of a tactical advantage. But the bottom line is they do not shift the strategic picture. They do not have the desired outcome for the perpetrators, and that's the important point.
Okay. Now let me turn to Beirut. Julia, U.S. Defense Secretary was meeting with Israeli officials at the time of the Natanz sabotage. He spoke of everything except his country's opposition, to Tel Aviv's sabotage of the Iranian Natanz facility. Why should Washington engage in talks to revive the nuclear deal, as it is claiming, at the same time, allow Tel Aviv to target Iran's nuclear facility?
Yeah, as was just said, that the cyber attacks against the centrifuges, it has been a tactic in the works for over 15 years now. The first time that it was implemented was through actually a Dutch mole in collusion with both the CIA and Mossad. So time and time again, these cyber attacks have been an act of collusion between the United States and Israel, which kind of do not act independent of each other or robustly, I believe. So it's pretty understandable that there is a collusion going on in their aims of sabotaging Iran's nuclear program. Right now, the Biden administration is kind of operating under the facade of wanting to do negotiations, but on the U.S.'s terms, which is why essentially the talks failed, as the deal failed as well. And with Israel, it's just more of a rogue strategy of kind of achieving the same objectives of sabotaging Iran's nuclear enrichment development. But of course, as we know, Israel is very short-sighted in that regard. Those centrifuges, as was mentioned, were old anyway. They were due to be replaced. So Iran's response in resistance to Israel's attack, but also in full assumption of its own right to develop energy, sovereign energy, has chosen to increase the enrichment to 60% as of tomorrow. So I believe that based off the historical precedent of these cyber attacks, as well as the coinciding goals that both the U.S. and Israel have against Iran, ultimately, that they couldn't have been acting independently, of course.
Okay, now, Mahan, in the same lines, I want to put this question. Could Tel Aviv have taken this hostile action it took against Iran without informing Washington and getting its green light?
Well, the short answer is no, and I tend to concur to some extent with your guest in Beirut. These actions, these sabotage actions or cyber attacks or other forms of hostile activity, they tend to be collaborative. So it's a case of collusion between several hostile states. Very rarely do they happen independently. Now, we know with the biggest attack to date, there's the so-called Stuxnet attack back in 2010. This was a collaborative effort between the Americans and the Israelis. Now, we don't have sufficient information to determine the extent of collusion in the latest attacks. But the bottom line is that the Israeli entity, you know, it doesn't have the strategic capacity or even wherewithal to act independently. This is this is an established fact, I think, and most experts would concur mm-hmm. with that. So, and of course, this creates all sorts of questions because some of these hostile states, whilst they're trying to actively sabotage Iran's nuclear program, they're also at the same time pretending to be engaged in dialogue and diplomacy. So that really calls into question their motivation and their sincerity. And I think this is something which the Iranian diplomatic establishment has to contend with. Just how serious mm-hmm. are their diplomatic interlocutors sitting at the other side of the table? Yes.
And of course, Iran has not waited for that, Mahan. Iran is doing its job no matter what comes out of those negotiations.
Well,
now, let me, if you want
to
go ahead.
Just to finish my point, absolutely.
Sure.
So, there are several dimensions here. There's the security dimension, the strategic dimension, and the diplomatic track.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained with the actual nature of these attacks, the damage that they inflict on Iranian infrastructure is at best tactical. They don't change the big strategic picture. And most important of all, they do not alter Iran's strategic calculus. And today's announcement is a testament to that.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has announced that it's going to actually intensify its activities in the nuclear sphere in response to this particular sabotage operation.
Right. Julia, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif has asserted that neither sanctions nor sabotage can serve as a lever for Washington in the nuclear-related negotiations going on, as you know, if that's what they are pursuing. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, actually both of those things have been factors to actually motivate Iran to pursue its more sovereign strategies of nuclear enrichment, economic development, nuclear development, but it kind of goes to show it's a miscalculation on the U.S. end, and it's why it almost seems like the strategy of getting Iran to negotiate on the West terms seems like a little bit more of kind of like a diplomatic way of actually sabotaging it and slowing down its nuclear development. As we can remember, a couple days ago, it officially looked like the talks were failing, even though the premise of them, where Washington didn't want to remove the sanctions, poised it to fail from the get-go. But as we kind of saw the confirmation of Washington, not wanting to remove the sanctions, not wanting to live up to its commitments, really. I believe that Israel kind of like launched this last-ditch effort to try to sabotage the centrifuges. But of course, just like the sanctions, that only encourages Iran to further move on its plans to develop its enrichment, you know, enrich its uranium and kind of produce a more sovereign strategy of economic development, given that, you know, the parties on the other side of the table directly or in collusion with these sabotagers to begin with.
Let me ask Mahan this question that Tehran has strongly criticized, Mahan, what it calls Tel Aviv's nuclear terrorism. Because it wouldn't only impact Iran, it could have led to a large-scale environmental issue endangering other parts of the world, too. So the end justifies the means. That's the Israeli approach, right?
Well, this is a really good question, and it speaks to the recklessness of these attacks. The attacks we've seen over the past 15 years have been really dangerous because they are targeted at critical infrastructure. In this instance, a nuclear facility. We know that nuclear facilities the world over are vulnerable assets. We saw the Fukushima thing back in Japan in 2011. Other instances when nuclear infrastructure, civilian ones for that matter, somehow become vulnerable, and that disposes huge environmental challenges and huge pressures. Now, in this instance, thankfully, there hasn't been an environmental impact, but the fact remains that attacks of this kind, with callous disregard for the immediate environment, indeed the broader environment, and as you just stated, potentially the global environment, it speaks to the recklessness of these actors. So if the question is, does the end justify the means? Certainly from their point of view, it does. And this just goes to show how important it is for them to halt Iran's progress in the scientific sphere. You know, they are absolutely obsessed by this because they've been taken aback by Iran's strategic momentum in other areas, in the regional domain, but Iran and its allies are victorious. They have the strategic advantage. They have seen how the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy, which amounted to the of an attempt to economically paralyze Iran, they saw that has not worked. The Iranian economy has proven to be much more resilient than they ever anticipated. So they have seen these gains on Iran's part. They have seen that they cannot get the strategic advantage in a conventional sense. So they resort to these attacks with a view to arresting Iran's strategic momentum, with callous disregard for anything else, be it civilians, you know, civilian casualties and damage to the environment.
Julia, Iran has stated clearly that it does reserve the right to revenge in due time, and some analysts criticize it for not giving a strong response to the Israeli move, and there are some others who are praising this as self-restraint that's being practiced by Iran, which they argue that nullifies Tel Aviv's intention to instigate Tehran to kind of rush to take some hasty and harsh action in response. In what context do you assess Iran's stance?
Yeah, so I would say that it's not, you know, restraint in the sense that it just kind of wants to be the peace broker just for the kind of, for a pacifist sense. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that there's really anything to criticize because, I mean, one, what do most of us know about the strategic analysis that Iran is really taking with regards to its response? But also, Iran's not going to respond on Israel's timetable because Israel's going to want to take harsh action based on what it believes is going to be advantageous to it and enable it to kind of wage further strikes against Iran in just a very restless way, of course. Of course, Netanyahu wants war. Of course, the Zionist entity wants war. And they want it in a way that gives them the second strike advantage and that could be predictable in their regard. So, of course, Iran is going to respond, but it's going to respond strategically. It's going to respond with full intentionality and with full respect to its strategy, its own strategy, not Israel's. So I think this actually is what really terrifies Israel, that it is able to have short, you know, a lot of restraint in the short run, in order to achieve its goals in the long run. And Israel knows it can't, it can't really be successful in any military confrontation ultimately against Iran. So it just tries to also sabotage them militarily by inciting some kind of short-term, small-scale
Now, Mahan, as you know, negotiations are underway in Vienna, and Arafat is there, and they are starting it tomorrow officially. Not much was achieved in the first round of the Vienna talks last Friday, though. So, what do you expect could come out of the second round that's starting tomorrow? Will go on for a couple of days. Tehran has asserted, of course, as you know, that it wants all the U.S. sanctions. You know, and all the U.S. sanctions means those imposed during the Obama term, during the Trump term, to be removed at one go.
Well, as far as diplomacy in Vienna is concerned, Iran's position really hasn't changed. Iran's position was set out some time ago by the leadership and then further down by the institutions that are tasked with foreign policy. So Iran's position is if Iran is going to scale back its actions of the past 18 months to go back into full compliance mm-hmm. with the JCPOA, then sanctions not only have to be fully lifted, in fact, they have to be verifiably lifted, and that takes time. So it's right. No good for the Americans to say, oh, we're going to lift sanctions. Can you go back into your commitments now? Absolutely not. These have to be verified. Mm-hmm. For instance, Iran will have to be able to sell its oil in the international markets without any obstacles or hindrance, and other sanctions.
And also get access to the money.
Yeah, and other sanctions. I was about to say that. Other sanctions mm-hmm. targeting the financial sector, Iran's blocked assets around the world, they have to be unfrozen, and Iran needs immediate and full access to mm-hmm. that. So these have to be verified. So the position in that regard hasn't changed. But look, just take a look at the discussion we've had this evening. Now, if this proves to be a synchronized attack by, say, two hostile states, I'm not going to name them because we don't have that information. So this is purely speculative. If one party, for instance, hopes to gain some kind of leverage over this attack. So, they would argue that Iran's leverage has been removed as a result of this attack, so it's easier to negotiate with them. Then the Iranian negotiators are going to prove them very wrong, because that bottom line is not going to change. It didn't change with the first round of the Vienna negotiations, and I suspect it will not change with the second one. And let's take stock of the broader strategic picture. The former U.S. administration imposed what they called maximum pressure policy in Iran, which amounted to a kind of economic blockade. That was an abysmal failure. The current administration in the U.S. concedes it was a failure, and yet it doesn't have the moral courage or the political conviction to actually reverse that policy. Mm-hmm. So until they reverse that mindset and reverse that policy, there's not going to be progress on the diplomatic aspect.
Okay, that's all the time we have had for this debate show. Let me thank my guests, we had security analyst Mahan Abedin in Tehran and journalist and commentator Julia Qasem, who joined us in Beirut in Lebanon with their comments and insight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today, throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Chapter 12 is the last chapter in part 1 of Mafatih Al-Hayat, and Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli in this chapter discusses entertainment and healthy entertainment, things that we are able to do in our individual lives that would be a part of our, if we could say, recreation. That could be a hobby, that could be sport, that could be entertainment. But what are the boundaries that one needs to observe when it comes to these kind of things? And also, what is it that Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam have spoken about when it does come to something like what we call healthy entertainment or healthy recreation and sports? Hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, "Ulhu." Wal'abu, have your lahu, have your la'ib. You know, when we keep on saying al-lahu wal-la'ib is, you know, something condemned in Islam, something bad, and all these other things. But no, not necessarily. There are many, many cases and circumstances where it is not only something good and beneficial, but also something recommended. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, ulhu wal'abu. Play and have your entertainment, have your recreation. فَإِنِّي أَكْرَهُ أَن يُرَى فِي دِينِكُمْ غِلْظَةٌ, because I hate for me to see any kind of rigid hardness in your religion, which means as a religious person, you shouldn't be rigid, you shouldn't be extreme. You shouldn't have that level of a hardliner kind of personality as a religious person. Remembering, the Quran says, لَا تَنْسَ نَصِيبَكَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he says, اِجْعَلُوا لِأَنفُسِكُمْ حَظًّا مِنَ الدُّنْيَا بِإِعْطَائِهَا مَا تَشْتَهِي مِنَ الْحَلَالِ. Allocate for yourself from this dunya what you want, what you desire, as long as it is halal. You want to play any kind of game, for example, those consoles, Xbox and PlayStation, Nintendo, whatnot, do so as long as it's halal. You want to go fishing, do so as long as it's halal. You want to watch television, do so as long as it's halal. You want to have any kind of hobby of your choice, do so as long as it is halal, as long as you are not falling short of your other huquq, your other rights that you have. That's also something extremely, extremely important as well. You know, you don't want to be someone who becomes so obsessed with these kind of hobbies so much that you are falling short of other things. You know, you want to collect cards. Fine, collect cards, you know. But remember that when it comes to paying all of these things, you're also fulfilling your other financial Islamic obligations as well, which is an important point for us to always remember. مَا لَا يَثْلِمُ الْمُرُؤَةِ. You know, you also want to remember that, yes, it needs to be halal, but it also needs to bring about your level of righteousness and nobility. You don't want to do something that is against your self-dignity. You know, find a hobby that is good. Find a hobby that is nice. Find a hobby that will elevate you in your community, in your society, that people will think good and positive of you. You don't want to find something or do something that is useless, that is baseless, that is not going to be in any way productive to you or anyone else in the society as well.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه.
This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
وَمَا لَا سَرَفَ فِيهِ As long as it's not israf as well, you're not doing any kind of wasting. وَاسْتَعِينُ بِذَلِكَ عَلَى أُمُورِ الدِّينِ And through your hobby, through your recreation, through your entertainment, through the sports that you are actively involved in, it will give you the power and strength, mental and also physical, in order for you to pursue affairs and matters of your religion as well. فَإِنَّهُ رُوِيَ Because Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he continues on, it has been narrated, لَيْسَ مِنَّا مَنْ تَرَكَ دُنْيَا لِدِينِهِ One who abandons their dunya for their religion is not among us. So balance is very important. Deen needs to be there. Your dunya also needs to be there in the halal way and along with all of these other conditions. So of course, clearly we can see that there are many, many benefits for recreation, for having a hobby, for having entertainment. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, السرور يبسط النفس ويثير النشاط. You being happy, you being joyful, you being positive is going to bring about a lot of good psychological effects as well. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, when it comes to giving examples, Islamic examples, of what kind of entertainment are we talking about? What kind of recreation? We know that there is one thing that Islam emphasizes on very much, and that is ar-rami, or archery. Another thing is horse riding. Another thing is swimming. These three things have been mentioned frequently in many, many ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. أَحَبُّ اللَّهُوِ إِلَى اللَّهِ تَعَالَى The best form of entertainment in the eyes of God, إِجْرَاءُ الْخَيْلِ is for a person to ride a horse, warrami, and also archery. There are numerous ahadith that speak about that. قَالَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ كُلُّ لَهُ الْمُؤْمِنِ بَاطِلِ All types of entertainment is batil, except إِلَّا فِي ثَلَاثِ Except in three things. Of course, we need to understand this within the context. فِي تَأْدِيبِهِ الْفَرَسِ In disciplining a horse, you know, in taming a horse. وَرَمِيهِ عَنْ قَوْسِهِ In shooting arrows from their bow, from a bow, from your bow. وَمُلَاعَبَتِهِ إِمْرَأَتَهُ And having intimate time with his wife. These kind of things are, this kind of lahu, this kind of entertainment, is something that is encouraged. فَإِنَّهُنَّ حَقٌّ Because these are, of course, positive rights as well. وَالْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَالصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَى سَيِّدِنَا مُحَمَّدٍ